What to do, Sade?
Murder stories lull the baby to sleep, okay?
We're a little weird at first, but you get used to us.
We're your favorite sisters.
Except for if you have your own sisters, probably.
No, but I'm gonna be, you know, your favorite.
We're gonna bump them bitches out of there.
Kick rocks, other sisters. No one likes you.
Kick rocks.
Wake the fuck up or shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear about that.
You just told them I like to poop. It'll be an adventure, and we hope that you come along for the ride. Please subscribe.
You'll make the baby cry if you don't.
Yeah, don't upset Ethan by not subscribing. That's just rude.
Welcome to Suspicious,
a podcast with two sisters
who are a bit obsessed with true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
extraterrestrials,
and all things strange.
Stay a while.
Let's get weird. Hey guys, welcome to Suspicious, week two.
Second episode.
I know you were so excited.
All the excitements. Calm down, guys. Calm down. Simmer down. I can't talk over your shenanigans. So we're going to take a break until you can settle it down.
Let's wait till you're ready.
Okay, how about now?
Y'all ready? Y'all ready for this? Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun. Trademark song. Dun, dun, dun. It's not ours. Dun, dun, dun. Don't fine us. Dun, dun, dun.
We aren't rich. FYI, my sister has a baby, so if you hear any cooing or toys in the background, we don't care. Mom life.
Distraction.
Each week, we're going to tell you a couple of stories that are somehow related.
Ish. And
it's like a choose your own adventure on how they're connected.
Yeah, you just, you know, make your own connections.
Exactly. It's
people connecting with people.
Over crime. Blood. So would you like to tell your story first? Why'd you give me that face? You know, like, you ever see that video of that little kid? And he was like, blood?
No, I have not.
It's so cute. Okay, so week two. What are we getting into?
Okay. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you the story about the unsolved case of the death of Edgar Allan Poe.
Here for it. Never heard it. Excited about it.
Ready? All the things. Okay. The end. Done.
Ready? Okay.
All right. So we're going to do a little info on Mr. Edgar Allan Poe beforehand, before we get into like the craziness. So just like a general summary. So he was born January 19th, 1809. He was born in Boston, Massachusetts. If you don't know who he is, he's an American writer, a poet, an editor, literary critic. He's best known for his short poems and stories like The Raven or Telltale Heart. And he also married his cousin.
Yummy. So he's from Alabama? Just kidding. Boston. Sorry for anybody who's listening from Alabama. My apologies.
Boston, Massachusetts.
It's kidding.
A kid. So, the circumstances that actually led to Edgar Allan's death are still pretty uncertain, and the cause of death is widely disputed. So, before his death, we knew no. Blah, 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 blah. Let's try that again. So, before his death, we do know a few things. So, on September 27th, 1849. He left Richmond, Virginia, and he was headed to his home in New York City. What's weird, one, is that we don't really know any of his whereabouts between September 27th and October 3rd, 1849, when he was found in Baltimore. So on October 3rd, he was found by a passerby named Joseph Walker. And he was found in front of a bar called Ryan's Tavern. And Joseph noted that Poe was delirious and incoherent, and he was kind of just slouched in front of the bar.
So wait, he was supposed to be going to New York, but he was found in Maryland.
Yes, Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yes. And so Joseph Walker, he was a printer. And he's quoted to say that when he found Poe, Poe was in great distress and he was in need of immediate assistance. So Poe was taken then to a hospital called Washington College Hospital. And he actually was kept in a very confined prison-like room with barred windows, which is normally customary for that section of the hospital. And that normally houses drunk people. So it was like a drunk tank, basically.
Yeah.
And then Dr. John, all these people with these multiple names, Dr. John Joseph Morin, he was the attending physician for Edgar Allan Poe. And a lot of the last few days, the accounts of his last days and what happened have come under question. And Dr. Morin's credibility has been challenged greatly. And so it's basically like he's not really credible anymore is what it kind of turns out to be. But we'll get into...
Ethan said he didn't believe him either.
Well, we'll get into it later, kind of towards the end about Dr. Morin's elaborations on things, we'll say. So, 4 days after arriving at the hospital, Edgar Allan Poe would be dead. He died October 7th at about 5 a.m., and he was 40. Which is funny because if you look at the photos of Edgar Allan Poe, he looks a lot older than 40.
I'm going to Google while you talk.
That's kind of par for the course, at least how I've noticed. Like, people back in the day always looked a lot older than their age. And it maybe just is the hard living or whatever, but...
Yeah.
He definitely, at least me being almost 40... He definitely, to me, looks older. Like, a lot older.
Like, I feel so much younger than Edgar Allan Poe.
Like, I'm so young and virile. I don't know. Anyway. Okay, so, unfortunately, though, Poe was never able to be coherent enough or awake enough to fully explain how he was found in the condition he was found in. So, the cause of death... is, like I said, was widely disputed. There are many, many theories about how he actually died. A local newspaper at the time attributed his death to congestion of the brain, which is a common euphemism for alcohol poisoning, which I will say I do love the euphemisms at the time, how they explain things, because it just sounds so much more, like, fanciful. Congestion
right.
of the
Instead
brain.
Instead of, like, he was addicted to alcohol.
He just drank too much. So some of the
cirrhosis of the liver,
right? But again, that's disputed.
It's just a theory.
Distributed, not distributed.
They distributed that.
It's
in all the papers.
Words are hard. But there's been many other theories as well on his death, such as suicide, depression, murder, cholera, hypoglycemia, rabies, syphilis, emphysema. I'm sorry, not emphysema. Influenza. I was doing so good.
So similar.
It is. And even a victim of cooping. And
pooping?
Cooping. Pooping. He didn't shit himself to death.
He died on the toilet.
He didn't have dysentery. That's dysentery.
I really thought you said pooping.
No, cooping. COOPING. So, let's talk about cooping. Cooping is a form of electoral fraud where citizens were kidnapped off the streets and forced to vote over and over for a candidate. Kind of like you see in, if you've seen Gangs of New York.
I have not.
Oh, what?
You're going to come across this many times, Angie, where you're like, oh, have you seen this movie? And I'm going to say, no.
You should watch Gangs of New York. But anyway.
My whole life, people are like, you haven't seen that movie? Sorry. Yeah.
So in Gangs of New York, they do cooping as well. But basically, they take a candidate, or they take people and they kidnap them and they force them to vote over and over again for a candidate so that candidate wins. So according to several biographies, cooping gangs, as they were known, would hold random victims in a room and ply them with alcohol to get them to comply, or they'd face beatings. Often these victims were forced to change clothes multiple times to fool the voting offices. So part of the reason that people do believe that this actually did happen to Poe was because when he was found, he was wearing clothes that were not his, and his appearance was not normal, so much so that people commented on it. So Dr. Joseph E. Snodgrass, acquaintance.
What a name.
I know. I actually knew a girl in high school. Her last name was Snodgrass.
Snodgrass?
Side note. Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, so.
Fun fact.
He was, Dr. Joseph was an acquaintance of Poe, and he was contacted, and his first-hand account is described Poe's shocking experience as quote-unquote repulsive. His hair was unkempt. His face looked haggard. He was unwashed. His eyes appeared to be quote-unquote lusterless and vacant. The clothes that he was found in were dirty and not his normal attire at all. He had a shirt on with no vest. He was in unpolished shoes that were very worn and did not fit well at all.
Ethan says, how dare he wear a shirt with no vest?
He is frustrated on that. He's like, what? How dare? How dare he? But the shoes apparently didn't fit very well. Even Dr. Morin stated that Poe was in, quote, a stained, faded, old bombazine coat, pantaloons of similar character, a pair of worn-out shoes, run-down heels, and an old straw hat, unquote. So if you've ever seen a picture of Poe, normally he's in like a suit, or he's in, you know, he's in like black jacket, black pants, white shirt. Like he has his black hair. It's usually kind of coiffed. It's once you've seen him, you'll know. You know what I mean?
Like that's pretty much coiffed is a word.
Coiffed is a word.
No, coiffed.
Coiffed. Look it up. Google it.
Coiffed
is a word.
I am gonna have to Google.
You Google.
I know coif is a word.
But... Google that shit.
Quaffed.
No, quaffed. Coiffed.
It's just called coiffed hair, not coiffed.
Coiffed. So, again,
we'll go with it. We'll go with it. Okay.
So, again, Poe never woke up enough to be coherent, to explain his appearance and kind of what happened. So it is an accepted statement that his clothes that he was wearing were not his. And Poe had never been seen in shabby clothes previously. So it was very, very out of character for him. And the other part of the cooping theory that makes it more plausible is that when he was found, he appeared highly intoxicated, but by all evidence, this is strongly disputed, and a lot, if not all of the rumors about him being drug addicted or addicted to alcohol were greatly exaggerated, especially by vindictive literary critics who just were out to kind of slander Poe. So as an example, Rufus Wilmot Griswold was a rival and published the first full biography depicting Poe as depraved, drunk, and drug addicted, and basically called him like a madman. And again, much of the info that Rufus published is believed to be faked by him. Dr. Snodgrass was convinced that Poe died of alcoholism and that he had done a lot to popularize this theory. And Snodgrass's writings on this have also been proven to be untrustworthy. So a lot of people just making up crap.
He was found outside of a bar. Well, so
according to reports, people who knew and spent time with Poe said that he only drank during very difficult times in his life, and he went several months without drinking. Also, he belonged to the Sons of Temperance at the time of his death. And so the Sons of Temperance was a Brotherhood of Men who promoted the social movement against alcoholic beverages, and typically criticized alcoholic intoxication, and they promoted complete abstinence from alcohol. So he was an active member in that at the time that he was found. So that's what lead many people to think that Cooping is most likely the cause, basically. Like they got him all liquored up, changed his clothes, forced him to vote and do all this stuff, and that's kind of what,
I mean, it sounds
caused it.
Suspicious. Dun dun dun. Wait, so I have a question on the Cooping.
Yeah.
So why would his appearance and not wearing his normal clothes have anything to do with Cooping? Like, did they normally steal people and give them clothes that aren't theirs?
Yeah. Like I said before, it was not uncommon for them to make people change their clothes multiple times to fool the voting, because they'd go to the same voting office, or they'd go to a few of them, and they'd make people vote and vote and re-vote and vote some more for the candidate they wanted to win.
Yeah. Okay.
So, okay. There's also a theory that Poe may have died by suicide from depression, as back in 1848, he nearly died of an overdose of laudanum. And laudanum is painkiller or tranquilizer of the time. But with that episode where he almost OD'd, it is unclear if he actually, if it was an actual attempt to kill himself, or if it was just an honest miscalculation of the dosage. And apparently in 2020, so more recent.
Last year.
Someone did a psychological analysis of Poe's language in his writings, and they theorized that Poe suffered from a major depressive episode near the end of his life. However, evidence of suicide is not consistently present in his writings. So this leads the researchers of the article or paper to believe that suicide was unlikely. And drug use is also disputed by Dr. Thomas Dunn, English, who happened to be an enemy of Poe. It's hard to read my writing. He was actually an enemy of Poe, and he actually said Poe was not a drug user. So that again goes to the credibility that he wasn't really into drugs and alcohol. If one of his enemies is like, no, I've never seen him drug addicted.
I hate the dude, but he ain't a drug addict.
Exactly. So again, all of Poe's medical records, including his death certificate, are lost if they were even created at all. Which again makes it difficult to decide or to determine how he died, what was going on, any of that. So when Poe was also in the hospital, he apparently reportedly called out the name Reynolds repeatedly on the night before he died. And no one is really clear on who Reynolds was.
Obviously, Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
I call out for him every night, too. Just kidding.
You do, though. So no one was clear who Reynolds was. It could have been Jeremiah Reynolds, which was an editor of a newspaper. Or it could be Henry Reynolds, which is one of the judges who oversaw the Fourth Ward voting polls at Ryan's Tavern, where he was found, if you remember. Mm-hmm. Or it could have been Herring, not Reynolds. I don't know how those sound similar, but I guess they do. Because I guess Poe had an uncle-in-law in Baltimore named Henry Herring.
Yeah, Herring and Reynolds really don't sound similar at all.
No, they don't.
I'm trying to picture somebody screaming it out or saying it in their sleep, and it don't.
It doesn't make any sense.
I saw a baby butt.
You do see a baby butt. Because he is joining me momentarily. So, Dr. Morin avoided all reference to Reynolds, and apparently mentioned a visit by Mrs. Herring to Poe. He also claimed that he, Dr. Morin, attempted to cheer up Poe on one of the last few times that he was actually like awake. And Dr. Morin said that he told Poe that he would soon be in the company of his friends, and to which Poe allegedly replied, the best thing his friends could do would be to blow out his brains with a pistol, quote unquote.
Charming.
Oh, right. But again, as previously reported, Poe was never coherent or awake enough to explain what happened. So could he really have stated like that whole little phrase? Like, why would you not ask him if he was coherent enough to say that? What happened? So in Poe's distress states, in Poe's distress state, reports said that he also made reference to his wife in Richmond, but it could be that he may have thought his wife, who her name was Virginia, was still alive. She died of tuberculosis at the age of 24 on January 30th, 1847. So 2 years before, a little over 2 years before.
Dang. So he was like the male version of Cougar.
Well, also to remember, his wife was also his cousin.
Oh yeah. Oh, cool. So, I forgot about that, but still she's super young.
Yeah. Or it's thought maybe he might've been referring to Sarah Elmira Royster, who he had recently proposed to. So was his fiance. Yeah. Not related to him as far as I'm aware.
So you could have multiple wives back then?
No, his wife was dead, but he had just recently proposed to someone else.
Oh, that's right.
So they're
right.
Not sure who he was referring to when he said
got it.
His wife, apparently. And Poe had no knowledge of apparently where his trunk with all his belongings were, which turns out was found in Richmond at a place called Swan Tavern. So not close to Baltimore. I don't know if there's a Richmond, Maryland, but I would assume Richmond, Virginia, but it didn't say.
Right.
So anyway.
There could be. I can Google while you're going to see if there's a Richmond.
And how far that is from Baltimore, if there is. So again, anyway, according to Dr. Morin, Poe's last words were, quote, Lord help my poor soul, unquote. With that being said, as I said before, Dr. Morin's credibility has been brought into question a number of times, and not a lot of what he said regarding or since Poe's death can be really trusted. Morin's story has changed pretty much with each time he lectured or he did any writings on the time. The doctor had previously claimed that he had contacted Poe's aunt and mother-in-law. They're the same person. Maria Clem, immediately to let her know of Poe's passing. And I even wrote, yes, same person. Wife who died was his cousin. In fact, he only wrote her after she had requested it on November 9th, almost a month after Poe died. So, like, why would he even lie about that? Like, oh, yeah, I immediately contacted her. But he didn't contact her. She contacted him.
Interesting. Inconsistent, sir.
Exactly. Why lie? Dr. Morin then claimed that Poe said the following while he was dying. Quote, the arched heavens encompass me, and God has his decree, legibly written upon the frontlet of every created human being and demons incarnate. Their goal will be the seething waves of black despair, unquote. So, two things. One, he previously said that Poe said, Lord, help my poor soul before he died.
Hmm.
And then two, apparently the editor of the New York Herald admitted after printing Dr. Morin's above statement in his paper said he cannot imagine Poe, even if delirious, constructing such sentences. It is claimed that Dr. Morin penned the fake last words to help console mourners. But again, like, why lie? Like, you came up with one story, now you're coming up with this other crazier story, but he wasn't coherent enough again to tell you what happened.
Right.
to say like it was cooping or this or that or whatever the case was. But now
so
you're going to.
Is the doctor just a liar, like a pathological liar, or is he involved?
Questions.
Any
I don't
answers.
Have those. I don't have all the answers. No one does.
I demand satisfaction.
So, oddly enough as well, Morin's account even changed with the dates that Poe was admitted to the hospital. So it went from October 3rd at 5 to October 6th at 9 a.m. to even October 7th at 10 a.m., which was the day that Poe died. And with each change in admittance date, Morin stated he had documentation and records to prove this, but he was never able to produce anything and nothing was ever found. And again, because the records were either lost or never created.
Suspicious.
100%. 100% suspicious.
100%.
100%.
Angie, are you drinking coffee?
I'm drinking coffee. Okay, so so Morin's last account of Poe's death was written and published in 1885. When Morin was 65. So many critics even claim that the inconsistencies in Morin's story and accounts are due to either errors in his memory, like if he was going senile, or an innocent disuse to want to romanticize the events.
I mean, I've also heard from, like, different documentaries and stuff that, like, experts say, like, especially if you're using eyewitness testimony to, like, help your case, it's hard because people's memory instantly changes. Like, whatever you just witnessed and you're trying to recall it even if it happened a minute ago, it's never 100% perfect. And then the more time that goes by, the more things change. Well, and then sometimes you think, like, sometimes you tell yourself something enough that then you believe that that's the truth.
Well, you know? Would think as a doctor, you'd have medical records
for sure that
to
is
to rely back on to help either prove or disprove whatever, you know, statement you're making. But again,
yeah,
nothing like that. So since no hospital record. Oh, nice.
Oh, I muted myself.
No, you didn't. I could hear it.
I muted myself.
100%. One of those little blips on there is you.
Am I not muted here? Am I muted? Can you hear
it? No, I can hear it on the phone now. You were muted on the phone, but you weren't muted on your headset.
It's on mute currently.
No, I can hear you.
Every time I've made a noise, I put it to mute. Like I moved a bag earlier. Did you hear me move a bag earlier?
Yeah, I did.
I saw you look up when I moved it, and I was like, oh, it must have been a coincidence because I have it on mute.
No.
Every time I've burped. I've burped several times.
I know.
On mute.
No.
You piece of shit. How dare it? Look. There's an icon for mute, and I'm on it. Awkward. Sorry, guys.
Do we need a disclaimer in the beginning of the episode?
Okay, anyways, back to the story.
Okay, hang on. Oh, okay. So, back to where I was. So since there was no hospital records or even a death certificate that has ever been found, it's still a mystery on the cause of death for Edgar Allan Poe. Poe is listed on his grave to have died October 7th, 1849, and he was originally buried at 4 p.m. on October 8th, 1849, on a Monday. His ceremony lasted a whole 3 minutes.
What?
3 minutes.
That's
even
outrageous.
Really upset about it. And he had...
Oh my God. We can't say that on the air, Ethan.
So it lasted 3 minutes. And he had a very, very small crowd of mourners that came. But a lot of this was attributed to the cold, damp weather of the day. So Poe was buried in a very cheap wooden coffin that lacked handles, didn't have a nameplate, and didn't have any cloth lining or even a cushion. His original burial plot had no headstone because apparently as the headstone was on its way to the church, it had been destroyed when the train was derailed. So Poe was buried towards the back of the church at Westminster Hall's burial ground. And in 1875, his remains were moved to a newer, larger monument that's located in the front of the church. And he's now buried with his wife, Virginia, and his aunt slash mother-in-law, Maria.
Is Virginia the second wife?
No, he didn't get married.
It was his cousin. Oh.
It's his cousin,
Virginia. Right, he didn't get married again because he died. Duh.
So he's buried with his wife, Virginia, and his mother-in-law aunt, same person, Maria. And so they were buried with Poe at a later date, but they're all buried together now. And on October 10th, 2009, Poe was given a second funeral in Baltimore where many, many more people attended, paying tribute and reading some of his works. And at the service, they had a replica of Poe's simple casket, complete with a wax cadaver replica of Poe.
Oh, my God. Interesting.
Yeah. And that is actually the story of Edgar Allan Poe.
I want to know how he died.
Mysterious death. I know. Inquiring minds want to know. No one
We need
does.
These damn documents, Dr. whoever you are.
Dr. Moore.
Dr. Lies-a-Lot.
Dr. Morin's last name is spelled M-O-R-I-N, like moron. So, I kept wanting to say moron, but.
Dr. Moron. I need to know more, Angela.
That is all I know or anyone knows.
Well, maybe in our afterlife, we can start interviewing some of these people. Get to the bottom of it. Report back in our next life.
Sure.
Okay. Well, my story, I wanted to see if I could tie it, if I could figure out, like, is there a poet who was a murderer? So I started, like, Googling that, and I did not find that. But I found an interesting story. So okay. I'm going to leave it a little mysterious. I may be jumping a little back and forth in time. So stop me if you have a question.
Stop. Hammer time.
No. Can't touch this. Okay.
Copyrighted. Oh, damn. Not by us.
We do not own this.
Don't sue us.
But
we have no money.
We don't. Please give us money. Okay. So this is the story of the murderer and the poet.
Okay.
So this story has a little bit of art dealing in it, a little bit of history, some religion, murder, all wrapped
Let's
up into one.
Let's get into it.
Let's do the damn thing. Okay. So the story begins with a famous writer and poet, Emily Dickinson. So Emily Dickinson was known pretty much for her poetry, but she was not well known during her lifetime. She ended up being more well known after she died. So she was born in Amherst, Massachusetts, and studied at Amherst Academy from 1840 to 1847. And after a short stint at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, she returned to her home in Amherst. She was a super private person. And she spent a ton of time alone. She was known to the locals as being very eccentric and eventually became nicknamed as the Woman in White because she almost exclusively wore all white clothing.
Okay, first off, side note. Yes. I don't trust anyone who wears all white all the time, all day, every day. It's
How do they keep it clean? How do they keep it clean?
It's not flattering. Anyway, go ahead.
If you're not wearing black, I don't know what's wrong with you.
All black every day.
So she never married, and later in life, it was rumored that she even rarely left her bedroom. She did, however, maintain friendships, but they were only via written correspondence.
I was going to say, via her bedroom?
So while she was a prolific writer during her lifetime, she actually only published 10 poems and one letter. And after she died, people kept finding her writings and getting it published, and so it ended up being over 1,800 total writings known to this date. And a lot of those poems, so she was known to write her friends and then include like a poem on their birthday or holidays or something like that, and they were never named or dated.
Like, so, hi friend, happy birthday. Here's a short poem.
And the poems had nothing to do with like the birthday or the person. It was like just was whatever like... she was going through at the time.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah, not like about like a potted plant or anything, but like Whatever.
Lewis, the potted plant, sits on the windowsill. Drip, soaks up
drip,
sun.
Drip, says the water can. So it took like a really long time for these writings to end up being discovered and published over time. So we're going to jump to 1997 in New York City, New York. A new Emily Dickinson poem was authenticated and sold by Sotheby's Auction House to the Jones Sotheby's. Public Library. Sotheby's.
Sorry.
No, you're good. So the Jones Public Library is the library in Dickinson's hometown of Amherst, and they bought the poem for $24,150. And this was in June of 1997. This was actually the first unpublished Dickinson poem in over 40 years. And her hometown library, they didn't have a lot of money and they couldn't really compete with some of the bigger places that wanted the poem. So they ended up raising a ton of money locally so that they could bring it home. In August of 1997, Jones Library returned the poem to Sotheby's, claiming that it was a forgery. Selby Kiffer, a senior vice president of Sotheby's, told the Washington Post, quote, "It's an extraordinarily good forgery. The correct paper for the period, the correct writing instruments for the period, which were the 1870s, the literary tone was quite good, and the imitation of the writing." So the breakthrough on this case came when a Dickinson collector informed the library that they had been offered that same poem back in the early 80s by a man named Mark Hoffman, who was then known as a legitimate document dealer, however was now serving a life sentence for a double homicide. And that's where our story begins. So Mark Hoffman was born December 7th, 1954 in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it was said that he was a below average student in high school, kind of somewhat of an outcast.
What? That's terrible. He was a below average student. He's known for being below average.
Sorry.
He didn't apply himself.
He was kind of an outcast. So he was into things like magic and stamp collecting and coin collecting. So he clearly wasn't like the most popular kid.
Can we just stop like classifying like weird stuff as being an outcast?
For sure. Like, I mean,
just saying, like,
who wants to be an in kid anyway? They're boring. So when he was about 14 years old, he started doubting the church, and this was mostly due to the fact that he found out that his maternal grandparents were still practicing polygamy for like the last decade, even though it had been publicly renounced by the church and like you're not supposed to be doing it anymore. So it made him kind of question the church in general.
Where did he live again?
Salt Lake City, Utah.
Utah, okay. That's what I thought.
So like Mormon capital.
Yeah.
When he was 18, he went on a 2-year mission for the church and was stationed in Bristol, England. And he only really accepted the mission because he had a lot of pressure from his parents and also just from the church itself. It was said, though, that when he was on his own in England, that he spent a lot of his time going to bookstores and libraries to purchase early Mormon materials and books critiquing Mormonism. When he returned from his mission, he enrolled in a pre-med program at Utah State University, and then in 1979, he married Doralee Olds, whom he later had 4 children with. So in 1980, Hoffman claimed that he had found a 17th century King James Bible that had a folded piece of paper stuck inside by a piece of gum. And according to the Mormon scripture, Joseph Smith History, which is the Book of Mormons, it was translated by Joseph Smith from golden plates with Egyptian characters. So the document that Hoffman claimed that he discovered seemed to be a transcript that Smith scribe Martin Harris had presented to Charles Anthon, a Columbian classics professor. Hoffman based his version of the document on the description that Anthon provided. And so his discovery of this kind of like made his reputation as a document dealer. Okay, so Dean Jesse, an editor of Smith's papers and the best known expert on handwriting and old documents in the historical department of the LDS Church, concluded that the document was a Smith holograph, which essentially means that it was the same handwriting, and so he deemed it authentic. So the LDS Church announced its discovery and in April of 1980 purchased it from Hoffman for $20,000. So Hoffman's like, sweet, dropped out of med school because now he has a good income coming in from documents. And he became a legitimate document dealer. So after he fabricated other historical significant documents, he became noted by the LDS Church as a history buff, and they kind of like put him on a pedestal for all of his Mormon discoveries. And the reason that his discoveries were so important to the LDS Church is because it's a fairly new religion, but they really don't have a ton of historical documents that back up the story from like how they started. So having these documents kind of like it solidified to them that, oh, everything that we've been told is true. In 1981, he discovered a document that, after going public, the New York Times headline read, "Mormon document raises doubts on secession of the church's leaders." So in the beginning, he was finding documents that confirmed the stories of the LDS Church, but because he actually wasn't a huge fan of the church any longer, slowly over time, he started discovering things that contradicted the stories because he basically wanted to embarrass the church. So the most notorious of Hoffman's Mormon forgeries is the Salamander Letter, which appeared in 1984. The letter essentially contradicted the story that Joseph Smith, who transcribed the Book of Mormon, stated that...
Worship salamanders?
What?
He worships salamanders?
No. So Smith said that some of the stories came to him from an angel, and that he had seen an angel and like... whatever. The
angel spoke down to him.
Exactly. Well, the Salamander Letter basically indicated that there was no angel and that Smith had seen a white salamander, and that's where he got his information from.
So it was a salamander.
Yeah. Which is like weird, but it was his way of like contradicting the original story. So Gerald and Sandra Tanner, who were known critics of the LDS Church, were actually the first to kind of raise questions on the validity and authenticity of the Salamander Letter, as well as other Hoffman discoveries. And even though those letters like strengthened their criticism of the LDS Church, they were suspicious. So they raised the question that those were fake. Document expert Kenneth W. Rendell later said that the absence of any indication of forgery was in the letter itself, but there was also no evidence that it was genuine. In addition to documents from Mormon history, Hoffman also forged signatures of many famous non-Mormons, including George Washington, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Daniel Boone, John Brown, Andrew Jackson, Mark Twain, Nathan Hale, John Hancock, Francis Scott Key, Abraham Lincoln, John Milton, Paul Revere, Miles Standish, and Button Gwinnett, whose signature was the most rare and therefore the most valuable of any of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence. And I will point out that I think it's highly ironic that he forged the signature of John Hancock, who is known for his signature.
Right? Hey, I'm just going to start forging all these signatures now, guys.
Yeah, I mean, what else are you going to do with your time? So despite actually making a good amount of money from all the document sales, Hoffman was in a lot of debt because he spent super lavishly to keep up his lifestyle. And he also purchased a ton of first edition books. So he was flying through money. In an effort to clear his debts, he floated around the information that he had the full McClellan collection. And McClellan was basically a high leader in the LDS Church. So he hinted that he had the McClellan collection, and he said that within those documents there were a ton of revelations that were unfavorable to the LDS Church. And so he was wanting to sell it and or trade for the money that he owed other people. So in reality, Hoffman had no idea where the McClellan collection was, nor did he have the time to create those documents. But the men who he had promised those documents to were starting to apply pressure and basically demand that he come up with the paperwork. And so to try to buy himself time, he decided that he was going to construct some bombs, as one does, you know?
Hey, I got to buy time for these forgeries. you know what I'll do in the meantime? I'm going to make some bombs.
Right. And his intention.
Like bath bombs?
No. So his intention was basically to bomb and kill some of the people that he was supposed to be giving these documents to. And so.
I know a way that I don't have to give documents to people. I'll just blow them up.
I'm going to kill you. So on October 15th of 1985, the first bomb went off, killing Stephen Christensen, a document collector. And his secretary was also injured with shrapnel when the bomb went off, but she survived. And then later that very same day, a second bomb went off. And this time it claimed the life of Kathy Sheets, the wife of Christensen's former boss, J. Gary Sheets. And basically, per Hoffman's plans, the police initially suspected that the bombings were related to the impending collapse of an investment business of which Sheets was the principal owner and Christensen was his protege. But unfortunately for Hoffman, the very next day, he was accidentally injured by one of his own bombs in his own vehicle. And so when some of his other business associates heard of it, they were like, oh, we might be next. Like, and they went into hiding, but the police ended up kind of like narrowing in on him as the suspect. So during the bombing investigation, police discovered his forgery business in the basement of his home. And then Hoffman was arrested in January of 1986 and charged on 4 indictments, totaling 27 counts, including first-degree murder, delivering a bomb, constructing or possessing a bomb, theft by deception, and communication fraud. A 5th indictment containing an additional 5 counts of theft by deception was added that same month. Hoffman initially maintained his innocence. However, at a preliminary hearing, prosecutors provided substantial evidence of his forgeries and debts, as well as evidence linking him to the bombs. Hoffman not only faced the prospect of death penalty in Utah, but was indicted on federal charges of possession of an unregistered machine gun. And then in January 1987, Hoffman pleaded guilty to 2 counts of second-degree murder, 1 count of theft by deception for forging the Salamander letter, and 1 count of fraud for the bogus sale of the McClellan collection. He added, no. He agreed.
He did not add.
None. He didn't add anything. He agreed to confess his forgeries in open court in return for which prosecutors in Utah and New York dropped additional charges against him. He was sentenced to 5 years to life, but the judge recommended that Hoffman never be released. In 1988, before the Utah Board of Pardons, Hoffman said he thought planting the bomb that killed Kathy Sheets was, quote, almost a game. At the time I made the bomb, my thoughts were that it didn't matter if it was Mrs. Sheets, a child, a dog, whoever. Within the hour.
That's the quote.
That's how he ended the quote. Within the hour, the parole board, struck by Hoffman's callous disregard for human life, decided that he would indeed serve his natural life in prison. Hoffman what? Also, I know, shocking.
They're like, wait, you just said you didn't care if you killed a child or a dog or like, okay, well, we're going to let you out. You're cool.
You have no remorse? That's fine.
come on down.
Hoffman told investigator Michael George that he was bewildered by the attention paid to his murder victims. Quote, I don't feel anything for them. My philosophy is that they're dead. They're not suffering. I think life is basically worthless. They could have died just as easily in a car accident. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in an afterlife. They don't know that they're dead. After Hoffman was imprisoned, he was excommunicated by the LDS Church and his wife filed for divorce. Hoffman attempted suicide in his cell by taking an overdose of antidepressants. He was revived, but not before spending 12 hours lying on his right arm, blocking his circulation and causing muscle atrophy. So, in the end, his forging hand was thereby permanently disabled. Sad.
Is it really, though?
No. Well, and that was the story of Mark Hoffman. But there is a Netflix documentary or docuseries that's coming out in early March called Murder Among the Mormons. So we should hopefully get some more details with that.
Interesting. So it'll be about him?
Yeah, I'm assuming it's going to go into more details about like his forgeries and all of that. Because so obviously I didn't get a ton into the details behind the documents that he was forging because that wasn't really the point of the story. But so not only was he forging like substantial Mormon history documents, but he was forging like American history documents and obviously poems from famous writers. And so it's not really known how many or what types of documents are still out there floating around that are his forgeries. Cry, cry.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Great job.
Thank you. Poetry, murder, boom, tied together.
Boom.
Do you know what's coming next week?
So on the next episode, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite places ever, Virginia City.
Nevada.
A murder that happened there. Back in old times.
Old timeies.
Old timey murders.
I wish I knew an old timey song. I don't.
No, failed. Fail.
I was going to make one up, but I don't even know how to start.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling.
Hello, murder time.
All right. Well, then that's it.
That's a wrap.
That's a wrap. That's our episode. Stay tuned for episode 3.
Yes. Next time on Suspicious.
Bye.